From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, inequality in the recovery, being poor in a natural disaster, how Harvey is impacting the economically vulnerable.
I'm still at a FEMA hotel. I'm trying to find a trailer or something, but there's nothing really out there. And, everybody's lost everything and whatever, so it's hard.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On August 25th, Harvey made landfall as a Category 4 hurricane and delivered tremendous damage across the Texas coast. The towns of Port Aransas, Rockport, Fulton, and other communities were the scenes of massive property loss. Mandatory evacuations for the area is credited for reducing the loss of life, but when people came home, many found they had no home to come back to. Much of the housing stock in the area is wiped out. Trailers, apartments, and homes were leveled. And while a historic disaster like Hurricane Harvey leaves no one unscathed, these events hurt the low-income, disabled, and communities of color the hardest. Typically, these are folks who were struggling to keep their heads above water before the storm. But with scant resources and a strained social safety net, many of the economically vulnerable are forced to leave their hometowns, resettle elsewhere, and suffer a significant loss of income, status, and identity. In short, these are the people who were dealt out of the recovery. To the credit of the state of Texas, there were efforts to mitigate the harm to the poor in Harvey's aftermath. Texas temporarily expanded the income limit for food stamps. The state also temporarily expedited benefits, loosened restrictions on what people can buy with government aid, and allowed schools to serve free meals to every student, regardless of their income. But we know from past hurricanes, public housing is not fully restored. In Galveston, after the 2008 Hurricane Ike, many low-income and elderly residents left the island because the city refused to rebuild more than 500 public housing units. We are already seeing a diminished community in Aransas County. The Aransas County Independent School District reports a 20% drop in its student population. Today, there are many still living in tents, cars, damaged structures, and hotels, waiting to see if they qualify for FEMA rebuilding resettlement assistance, or if there's any place to go back to. I met with some of those impacted in late November, and here's my story. The Texas coastal towns of Rockport and Fulton share all the destruction and misery Hurricane Harvey brought. They also share a boundary line. There you'll find the Shack Seafood Restaurant and Barbecue Smokehouse.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one.
Harvey ripped the roof off this eatery. That repair work still needs some finishing touches, but the Shack is back open. Customers are flowing in, and they all seem to want to talk about one thing, the storm.
They buckled. This is the kitchen. That's how much water damage was in there.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, from there to there. And that was my daughter's bathroom and my daughter's room.
Even the waitress, Loretta Patterson, shares her story as easily as pouring sweet tea. She pulls out her smartphone and swipes through images of her home's damage.
Through our house, a fence picket, through the back, into my house, out the front, like a missile. And then we had a lot of water damage.
Everyone has a different story, and some are more devastating than others.
That's the Shack's owner, Patrick Garza. He says for many hourly workers in the area, there was no point in staying.
My kitchen staff is, I lost four out of my kitchen, so.
They moved away?
Yeah, Houston, San Antonio. Their apartments were destroyed, and there's nothing to rent. You can't rent a place here.
This shortage of rooms and workers is slowing down rebuilding here. There aren't enough people to hire for contracting jobs. One result, a tent city sprang up on State Highway 35 leading into Fulton. At the entrance, there's a large hand-painted billboard with the American and Texas flags. It reads, Rockport Relief Camp, hot food, hot coffee, donations and supplies, free help.
I used to have this absolutely gorgeous 3.5 acres covered in fantastic live oaks and grass.
Sam McCrary's property is different now.
Our decor is early mid-century junkyard.
There's an organized chaos here. Open boxes of donated food and cooking equipment are stacked on tables that sag under the weight. There's a dining room table under one tree, heaped with donated used shoes. One tent canopy is called the office, where there's internet access. Stacked up papers and rules are posted on the board. "Lights out at 11 is written in big, bold letters. There's a food truck where most of the cooking takes place, and on its door is a handwritten sign that says, "Sam for Mayor." That's because, after the storm, McCrary quickly saw how people's lives were
turned completely upside down, inside out, and backwards.
She hadn't planned to set up a relief camp at her house, but realized somebody had to do something.
People had lost homes. They weren't going to have any place to sleep. So we knew there were going to be people that were not going to have access to water or food, especially hot meals.
For 8 weeks, McCrary says, she provided over 1,000 hot meals a day.
Well, people started coming to get supplies, pick up tents and sleeping bags and cots, and we're, you know, ask them, well, where are you going to put that? Well, I guess we'll take it out to the beach or whatever. Well, they were getting kicked off the beach. They couldn't camp there. So we just decided, okay, pitch your tents out here in the front.
McCrary says the population has dwindled to about 35, but was up to 80. Some guests are children who run around the camp freely, chasing chickens and riding bikes. And McCrary says she plans to fold the relief camp on December the 5th.
We've always required that people have jobs. We don't charge anyone anything to stay here or eat or for supplies, so they should be able in that period of time to get on their feet.
But go where? That's the problem. It's one Maria Gomez faces too.
I lost everything. I lost my house and everything.
I met Gomez coming out of the Rockport FEMA Disaster Recovery Center.
I'm still at a FEMA hotel. I'm trying to find even a trailer or something, but there's nothing really out there. And they gave me a list of potential apartments, but they're all full. I mean, you know, everybody's lost everything, and whatever is available, they snatch it up as fast as they can. So it's hard.
A new survey suggests that nearly half of the Hurricane Harvey survivors feel that they're not getting the help that they need to recover. The Episcopal Health Foundation, in partnership with the Kaiser Family Foundation, found that the economically vulnerable are losing the most in the storm's aftermath. Elena Marks is the president and CEO of the Episcopal Health Foundation.
What we see from this is that the damage is pretty significant. There are a lot of people who are still struggling. 40% of those surveyed reported some amount of damage to their homes. 20% suffered damages or loss of vehicles. And 50% suffered some kind of income loss. Either they lost a job, they lost time at work, but they've had an economic impact in addition to or separate from damage to property.
Now, Hurricane Harvey, it hit 24 Texas counties pretty hard, some worse than others. And they have different types of communities in each of those counties. Different people are feeling Harvey's impact in different ways. Some people have resources and others don't. And everyone's still trying to deal with this.
Exactly. And some communities have more robust infrastructure that helps you deal before, during, and after disasters than other communities. And that has to do with, you know, physical infrastructure, but also kind of social infrastructure, community cohesiveness. And the more you have on the front end, the easier it is to weather and then recover from a storm or any other kind of disaster on the back end.
So the driving question for me is, I've been doing some reporting from the coast and talking to a lot of people, and I'm just wondering, what is this area going to look like when it's recovered? And I'm putting recovered in quotation marks, because what we're going to end up with is a different kind of Texas coast, just like we ended up with a different kind of New Orleans after Katrina. And so what are you seeing?
One thing you can look at, I mean, you mentioned New Orleans after Katrina, the population on Galveston Island post-Ike declined and has not recovered and may never recover. And so we may see some population shifts. The people who responded to our survey who are the most in need tend to be lower income African American and Hispanic people. And the options they have for picking up and going somewhere else, even if that's the best thing to do, are really limited. And so the conversations that we're having even in Houston about oh, there's not enough affordable housing, and now a bunch of affordable housing has been wiped out. And you think, well, people will just pick up and go to a community where there's more of that. That's easier said than done when you are living paycheck to paycheck.
Elena Marks is the president and CEO of the Episcopal Health Foundation, which, along with the Kaiser Family Foundation, found that Hurricane Harvey's aftermath is harder for many vulnerable populations in Texas. One of the stopgap solutions offered by FEMA for the displaced is a voucher for a hotel. But in my reporting, I found that many of the economically vulnerable are living with deep financial uncertainty and have no plan for when the vouchers run out. From outside, the WoodSpring Suites in Corpus Christi looks like your average extended stay hotel. Like many others in the area after Hurricane Harvey, this four-story modern-looking building became a temporary shelter for newly homeless evacuees like Roshonda Anderson.
I've been here for damn near a month. Yeah, but I've been staying with somebody else because they wouldn't help me.
They would be FEMA. Anderson and her wife, Ashley Mader, were turned down for temporary housing by FEMA, so they're crashing here, sharing a room with a friend who did get a voucher.
It sucks, because I have nowhere to go.
Before Harvey, the couple lived in Rockport in a trailer that was destroyed by the 135-mile-an-hour winds.
So we're both stuck right now. Man, I hope I get help.
The rooms at WoodSprings are not big. They're Spartan, a little refrigerator, microwave, and a two-burner stove. Anderson says cooking's difficult since there are no pots or utensils, and eating takeout every day is expensive. Anderson is unemployed. Mader was working as a secretary, but the storm destroyed that business. There's no job to go back to. Like many who live on the economic fringe, Anderson and her family managed before Harvey by depending on each other, sharing what they had, using the economy of scale to dilute the cost of rent, meals, transportation, and utilities. But now the Anderson family is part of the Harvey diaspora, and home is WoodSprings Suites. It's admittedly a no-frills hotel, no pool, no lobby area, no complimentary breakfast or coffee. Reviewers on Google complained about a funky smell. I was on the first floor, can confirm, funky smell. Old cigarettes and mold.
It gets to you after a while, man.
That's James Benningfield. Unlike Anderson and her wife, he was able to get a FEMA voucher for his stay. Currently, over 45,000 Harvey evacuees in Texas are staying in hotels paid for with FEMA vouchers. That's costing FEMA about $3 million a day, and what happens next is up in the air.
I was getting extensions here, but then all of a sudden FEMA stopped extending, and they're only supposed to do it for so long.
Benningfield and other FEMA voucher recipients now have a cutoff date of January 16th.
I'm going to be homeless basically after that. I'll be in a tent with my dog on the beach or something, I don't know.
The dog is an 8-year-old pit bull named Monster. He's pulling hard on a chain Benningfield grips with his tattooed covered hands. Before Harvey, they lived at Benningfield's mother's house in Rockport. Now it's just shrapnel.
2x4s everywhere. I flooded underneath. The whole floor looks like waffles. Basically, all there is a toilet.
Benningfield says his entire future depends on him finding a job.
I'm almost out of money. I've been trying to get a job around here, but there's, you know, nobody really hiring or whatever.
Mike Fowalks came to the Suites 5 days earlier. He's visually impaired and disabled. When Harvey hit, he was sent to a hotel in Weslaco, 150 miles away.
Couldn't find any housing here. It was packed here. Everything was packed here. There was no housing here in Corpus.
His home in Port Aransas was destroyed, and he's having trouble getting back on his feet.
Yeah, they have me approved till the end of this month.
Today, he's hit a snag. The hotel clerk said his voucher is no longer working.
That's what they're saying, supposedly. We'll find that out. They told me differently today, though.
To get the housing glitch worked out, he's got to find a ride to the FEMA Recovery Center, which is about 5 miles away. It's a big white tent set up at the Corpus Shopping Mall.
Oh, I'm getting back over there to FEMA right now, actually. That's exactly what I'm doing right this minute.
Roshonda Anderson and her wife are also trying to go to the FEMA center.
Supposed to go to the tent today, get a ride, and see what they're going to be doing to me.
What does she want to do? Reunite with her family and friends.
They're everywhere, scattered everywhere right now. All over Corpus, Texas, basically all over Texas.
Do you think you're going to ever go back to Rockport?
I want to. That's my home.
But for now, home for Anderson is a stealthy stay at a FEMA voucher hotel with a funky smell. Hurricane Harvey won't be the last major disaster to hit the United States, and it wasn't the first. So what can we learn from looking at past disasters and how they were handled? And are we even asking, how can we do a better job to make sure that the vulnerable, the poor, the families of color, the undocumented, get the help that they need short-term and long-term? Steve Kroll Smith is a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro and has authored two books looking at Hurricane Katrina's recovery and the inequality of the recovery.
What tends to happen in a disaster like Katrina and New Orleans or Harvey, what we find is that the disaster retreats, but the anxieties remain, and what those anxieties reveal is something other than the immediacy of calamity. What they reveal is the stresses and strains of disaster relief. And for many of these people, disaster relief becomes the second disaster. And it becomes a far more chronic phenomenon, something that they live with years out. Even the middle class has trouble letting disaster go post-disaster. It stays with them in some kinds of ways. But it's compounded when you add not only the catastrophe and then the difficult efforts to navigate disaster relief, and you begin as a lower middle class or lower class individual. What's happening in Houston right now is similar to what happened in New Orleans.
You're saying that after a disaster, there is relief available, but that help is not always accessible. It's less accessible by people who are economically vulnerable. These are people who they lost everything. Mm-hmm. They have no savings. They have mm-hmm. no network mm-hmm. of support. Mm-hmm. Some people can bounce back in a recovery economically mm-hmm. If they mm-hmm. have those resources. But when you don't, when you're at the bottom rung of the economy, mm-hmm. you get what they call a dead cat bounce. You hit mm-hmm. the ground once and you don't come back up.
Right. You can't bounce back. And you use two words that are very important here, and that is available and accessible. FEMA makes relief available, and it's got policies that make this relief available, but it's the accessibility issue that becomes paramount for these folks. Many of them simply can't access the FEMA resources. It goes back to the power of the document. You have to have that documentation. It's not surprising. And it's something that we should anticipate when we have a market-oriented society. And in a sense, you've kind of got to be market-worthy. And what I mean by that is you have to have the documentation that you have property, that you pay your bills.
But there are people who are in the market, who are in the shadow market. I mean, mm-hmm. you have communities along the coast, industries that rely heavily on the undocumented, mm-hmm. and they have no resources. They have
right.
no way. They can't turn to FEMA.
And
what happens to them? We have people mm-hmm. who are multi-generational residents of these communities, and
right.
many of them have been working their entire lives, and now they're disabled after a lifetime of
right.
hard labor.
Right.
And then we also have people who are on the margins, LGBTQ, individuals who are low skill. They're part of the community as well.
Right.
What happens to these people? What happens to the community? Can you actually have a recovery if you're going to lose all these segments of your population?
You've already got a marginalized population, and at the same time, you've got a population that you kind of need in that area as a backbone, as a workforce. Well, let's be specific. So let's say that we're talking about a low income family, or we're talking about some kind of marginalized demographic of one sort or another. And you have, let's say, a number of people sharing a property because that's the only way that they can make it. And that takes place all the time.
Right. I saw a lot of people on the coast where you've got multi-generational families sharing the same house. So
right.
the house
okay.
belongs to grandma, and
mm-hmm.
then you've got, the daughter, and then the daughter's family,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
the grandchildren and mm-hmm. their family that
mm-hmm.
have started as well.
Mm-hmm.
And
so here's what happens. FEMA has what they call the shared household rule. And what the shared household rule means that there can only be one property owner in that household. So grandma owns the property, but she has extended kin living in the house. They're dispersed. They're trying to get relief from FEMA. The only person, based on property ownership now, that would qualify for FEMA relief would be grandma, in spite of the fact these other people are living there. So FEMA has this model of the two-parent, two-child sheepdog family, if you will, and that's the model that it uses when it assigns relief based on residence. And then you've got the HEIR property, H-E-I-R, property rule that FEMA uses, which means that, let's say that grandma dies and she goes ahead and gives this property to her daughter or her son, but there's not a transfer of title. There's not a transfer of deed. It's simply an oral agreement, and this happens all the time. Because they don't have that document, they don't have that deed to the house, even though they own it by virtue of grandma giving it to them, they don't qualify for disaster assistance based on home ownership.
So based on what you've seen on your research on Hurricane Katrina, a decade after the hurricane and so and on, what do you expect to see happen along the Texas coast? What will change?
Okay. So one of the things we're going to see, right, is we're going to see housing prices go up. There's no question about that. We're going to see rents go up. My guess is we're going to see a change in the demographic composition of Houston itself. I can't predict what that change is going to be, but we're going to see some change there. Some people are simply not going to be able to live there anymore for a variety of reasons. We're going to also probably see a downward drift in overall physical and mental health. And we begin to see an uptick in various kinds of medical problems, and we saw that in New Orleans. We also saw it with respect to psychiatric problems.
Steve Kroll Smith is a professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. He's authored two books looking at Hurricane Katrina's recovery. His latest book will be published in 2018 by the University of Texas Press, titled "Recovering Inequality." We're now in the thick of the holiday season, a time of the year that features food, big family meals, office parties, potluck lunches, and almost daily opportunities to indulge in decadent dishes. It's easy to forget that in so many parts of Texas, many won't be enjoying any of these things this year. Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides offers a reflection.
At the end of every semester, my students in Mexican American literature class write a brief food memoir. A personal narrative about some culinary ritual or tradition, a favorite dish on Sunday at Abuelita's, a disastrous dinner date, or adventures into the cuisines of other countries and cultures. The students never fail to agitate about the assignment, furrowing their brows as they stare up at the instructions projected on the screen behind me. I smile and say, "You got this," because they have. They have total command of the subject, this story. So elemental, so primal, but also, maybe, so easy to take for granted for that fact. I remind them of the writer's ready axioms about curiosity, about paying attention. "Be clenched curious," I say, quoting Susan Sontag. "Attention is vitality," I quote some more. "It connects you with others. It makes you eager. Stay eager," I say. The students write it in their notebooks. I share the funny story a friend of mine told me about how her mother confused the measurements for salt and sugar the first time she made pancakes for her husband soon after they married. I tell them about the ubiquity of rice dishes all over the world and try to see if they have what over the years we've come to term a rice story. A handful of students invariably do and share their own. I tell them to think about cooking shows on television, how the celebrity chefs are always telling stories, weaving a so-called culinary point of view around a narrative related to hearth and home. On deadline day, the students shuffle in as if they'd rather be anyplace else. Students stand or sit at the front of the room and read their stories, and their anxiety melts away. The shyest, most retiring one comes alive like he's doing a monologue on a late-night talk show, the laughter of his peers encouraging him, loosening up his rigid stance. He reads the story about the yearly tamalada at his tia's house, scheduled precisely during this time of year, in preparation for freezers emptied out to store several dozens for Navidad and Año Nuevo. A few students nod, relating to the details of the de facto division of labor among the members of the family. They agree that no one wants the husk-soaking detail, especially if we're having a rare frigid fall in San Antonio. We laugh at the funny anecdotes about the Frankenstein tamales the littlest members of the family make, their initiation to this cocina club ensuring their labors in the future, and the preservation of the recipe and tradition. All of the stories go this way. One student describes her mother's homemade tomatillo sauce. One shares a vignette about her military dad's concoction of a kind of spam nacho first created when he was stationed in Okinawa. One describes a potato salad, but never reveals the secret ingredient that makes it coveted by everyone at her church. One has us in stitches as she describes her first attempt at making mole from scratch and ended up with something that her brothers named Satan sauce after one taste. She said they still laugh about it, and it's been the source of good-natured ribbing for years. The repeated refrain with every story is the idea of family, the way food brings us together or bridges divides, helps mark a celebration, preserves memories for generations. In all the years I've assigned the food memoir, there's been only one story that didn't elicit the expected nods of resonance as each student describes something delectable prepared by loving hands in a warm, welcoming home. In immersing myself in all of the anecdotes, from poignant to humorous, I hadn't realized that while the stories were about the nourishment of the heart and soul, I had taken for granted the nourishment of the body. A few semesters ago, during one of these food memoir sharing sessions, a student described hunger, what it feels like to be hungry, the gnawing hole of hunger, this desperate state the consequence of living in poverty with a single mother. She reviewed the details of the abject misery of her lonely childhood with a voice calm and assured. I wondered about the chapter of her life that led her to a college classroom, in spite of odds I can't even imagine. That's the other story I hope she shares someday. Hurricanes and other horrors have clouded this year in all parts of our world. More recently, people in places like South Texas, the Coastal Bend in Houston, Puerto Rico, California, and Mexico have been hungry after devastation touched them, and they will likely be hungry again for food or creature comforts or life as they once knew it. Now, when I assign the food memoir, I still admonish my students with those trusty writer's truisms, the words that echo Sontag's, be curious, pay attention. But the reminder is for myself, too. Our world today reminds us to take nothing for granted. Sontag also famously said that writers, quote, evoke our common humanity in narratives with which we can identify, even though the lives may be remote from our own. The fullness of this reality can sustain us for a little while more.
Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.